Hello, everyone, and welcome to Across the Table. My name is Matt Mendoza, and I am your host. This is the 36th episode. My guest this week is a vintage expert. He is a St. Louis guy who is responsible for the creation of Uba Stacks, and with which he has won quite a bit of money. He's not a pro that you would recognize, but he has a lot of really interesting stuff to talk about. So without further ado, this is my interview with player, politician, general good guy, and altarist Robert Vroman. Oh, about that announcement this week, I'm happy to announce that my friend Ryan Dampf and I have started another podcast called Modern Untapped. You can check it out at modernuntapped.com. We, as you might guess from the name, talk about our favorite format, Modern, as well as some financial information, some strategy information. Thank you very much for your support. Enjoy the show.
And if I could have you tell me what you had for lunch today.
Sausage and eggs. Organic.
Are you big into organic food?
I am now. My best friend Greg talked me into it just because I don't really pay attention to what I eat. And so if I just shop at this place where it's a little bit more expensive, it's going to be 5 times better for me. So I'll just do that. So now it's just routine. I don't even think about it. Just shop at the health food store instead of Schnucks. And, you know, I put the exact same amount of effort into it, and the price doesn't, I don't really feel it.
I can't afford it. Mm-hmm. And I've heard not enough difference, evidence one way or the other that produce, for example, that organic produce is better than non-organic produce.
I certainly have, I've deliberately not looked into it at all. and just someone extremely smart, whose opinion I trust, said you should do this and not consume all the pesticides or whatever. Mm.
All right, so this week I'm with Robert Vroman. Vroman, you have been around for a long time in the St. Louis area.
Yes, I grew up here.
If you were to start your story, like the Robert Vroman story.
You mean in terms of magic or just my whole life story?
Your whole life story, where would you start?
Well, I grew up in Kirkwood. I went to John Burroughs, an elite private high school. And then went to WashU, promptly got expelled, and started a magic card store. If that catches us up to parts relevant to this podcast, I guess.
You got expelled?
I did get expelled from WashU. And then I went to SLU briefly, and then I dropped out of SLU specifically to start the first incarnation of Ogre's Games. When I started playing Magic seriously in, 2003. I quickly became good friends with kind of the inner circle, the St. Louis Magic players, Matt Stevens, a.k.a. Ogre, being one of them. And the summer of 2004, there was, two or three different Magic card shops all closed during that period. So there was an opening in the market. I had some money saved up. I'd become friends with, the most popular Magic players. So we opened a store, and I squatted in a vacant dentist's office upstairs from the former cafeteria where we ran the shop out of for over a year. I lived in that same building with my best friend and employee, Josh Smith. And during that time, I basically it was a dream job. I got to play Magic against the best players in the city for 6 hours a day, and we made enough money to pay the bills. And that was my life for 2 years. It was bliss. And I got really good at the little niche version of Magic that I like the best, Type 1 or Vintage. We can play with everything. And I engineered some notable decks, Uba Stacks, the old Workshop Prison deck. And then I did a pretty significant variant on Oath of Druids, which was, I guess, the conclusion of my career in 2011. I won a bunch more tournaments then. So I lived and breathed Magic full time for 2 or 3 years, basically instead of going to college. And I feel I'm a much better person for it. Magic is a great game. The time pressure, tactical decisions, in a tournament setting, to really succeed consistently at that, it was a fairly all-encompassing mental endeavor. I would get up and be thinking about it all the time. And I think about the world differently, having played Magic. Mm-hmm. At pretty high level for that sustained period of time, strategy, and then also running a business. I was an entrepreneur, and I wasn't fantastic at it, but we closed for reasons other than internal business problems. The business was doing okay. The building we were in got condemned. And then I was also, at the same time, starting to make some bad decisions with women. And those two together, I decided not to reopen a new location. We just closed. I guess you could say I was a Magic Pro, though not according to DCI. I was professionally supporting myself via Magic in multiple ways.
Gotcha. Let's kind of go to your, when you got expelled.
Yeah.
And how that sort of launched you into owning a shop and, like, how like, that expulsion kind of led to the beginning of your college education.
I never really got along with institutions in my entire life. I continued to be quite the rebel and of new fields now, thankfully. college, I already had a job. I had a pretty good job in high school. I was doing computer graphics for the Science Center, designing new exhibit. I wasn't the designer. I was just putting it into CAD. Was my main job, and also some kind of like animation stuff. So I really liked that job, and I kind of felt like that was going to be my career. And my parents and other family were very pressuring me to, you got to go to college, you got to go to college. So I was really not into it, and I made some pretty bad mistakes while I was in college, and I'd rather not go into details.
Okay.
But, they asked me to leave, and I was fine with that. It was a not, I was no tears, me leaving. I was at WashU. I got accepted to WashU. Lasted one semester there. And I, at that point, didn't really think that I was going to ever go back. I tried it a couple more times, again, at my family's insistence. But I really just prefer doing my own thing. I don't like having to... I've only ever been happy when I'm running my own business or just in some way doing my own project.
Okay.
I don't work for other people well.
And how did that lead into... You mentioned, like, your education that you got from... Magic.
Yeah.
Can you expand on that?
Right. So just being forced to think in this very tactical way with really, in the context of the game, really high consequences. In not many cases, we've driven like to Chicago. We've done 5 hours to play in this tournament. And we've been practicing for weeks or months. And yeah, you really got to be sharp. Just all the math of calculating what is my position, and then like kind of like the personal interaction, the bluffing, you know, outplaying your opponent. I think that the mental skills you have to succeed in that are very real life valuable. And in my case, I think I came away with that better than if I had just gotten some degree.
Okay.
I was an econ major, and I know a lot about economics, and yet I could not just sit in that classroom and listen to people tell me, you know, the status quo is fine, and, you know, I have major problems with the way the economic policy of this country, and just sitting there arguing with these pinkos, it was painful and pointless, and I would just walk out and not come back, and then I would get an F, and that was basically my MO at college. And I did not get along with my student, my peers, either. They thought I was a weirdo, I thought they were drones. I had an entire social life with mostly via Magic. I had basically no friends in college. I got the worst of college experiences you can imagine.
Okay. Now that's a nice chapter one.
Yeah.
Let's go way back.
Okay.
What is a young Robert Vroman like?
Let's see here. I played a lot of Legos and a lot of Nintendo. I was a child of the 80s. I have a distinct memory being in like second grade. Where I was a little bit, my family was a little bit behind the curve with the video games. So, like, Nintendo had been out for a couple of years. And I'm listening to my friends describe Nintendo, which I have never conceptualized what a video game is yet. I'm, like, 8 years old or something. And I'm imagining this, like, photo reel, you are controlling a movie in Zelda land or something.
Yeah, yeah.
And then when I finally get the actual Nintendo, it's miserable 8-bit graphics, I'll say that the very first moment, it was confusing letdown, but of course I instantly fell in love with it anyway, and played a lot of video games. I was not, I was definitely a geek all throughout high school, but I was kind of like the alpha geek. I was kind of like the leader of the geek circle, so I didn't really, I had a fine time in high school. I had a lot of friends, and we got, you know, didn't go out dating or anything, but
mm-hmm.
I was a nerdy guy, but I had a great time. So I would say my childhood was idyllic, or at least my circumstances, I navigated without any accumulating problems.
Cool. And when did you discover Magic?
I briefly played in like 7th grade. This is like the Dark or Revised or something.
Okay.
I knew how to play the game, and then I don't know. I got into other things. Played a lot of Quake, and I don't know. But friends were more into video games. That fell off, and then in 2003, I happened to move into the U-City Loop, and at the time, there was some Magic card shop was there.
Was it Wizards?
Hannah's okay. Games was there, and I lived like 3 doors down from it, and I easily got into it based on how I remember that game, and I'm kind of in a transition point in my life. Most of my social circle is out becoming doctors at UCLA or something. So I started playing Magic, and I quickly became... I have still some of my best friends. Most of my best friends I met through Magic.
Cool. And when you discovered it, were you like... Did you already know that this was going to be for you, or... Because you mentioned you kind of played it briefly in
just like
grade,
one like, summer in 7th grade, just enough to know how it works. I probably spent like $50 on it at that point.
Okay.
It's an extremely well-designed game. It's very elegant the way the rules, and there's the infinite custom ability. They can just keep making new cards. They've got like an algorithm for how to make rules, and the rules are always kind of interesting. I mean, they're really good at it. Magic is, and basically, I guess, it's in the genre that it is, definitely the best game. So yeah, I was very impressed, and it was a lot of fun, so I fell in love with it.
Cool. And like that whole period when you were younger and you were discovering gaming, did you ever see gaming as something more than what it was, like more than just a diversion? Or were you actually at that early age, like not second grade or whatever, but like when you got into high school, could you see yourself extracting from gaming certain things?
Maybe not at that time. Certainly in hindsight, I would probably take back most of the time I put into video games in my life. I would not take back the time putting into Magic. I think there was real value in that. I was really into chess in high school. I was first board on the chess team all 4 years of high school. I was the first Borough student to achieve that. So I was pretty good. Not good enough to go to tournaments in New York or anything like that. But solid for St. Louis. So I remained aware of Magic throughout high school just because I was playing chess all the time, so you interact with a lot of geeky guys.
Yeah.
And many of them still play Magic. For whatever reason, I didn't get into it at that time. But yeah, I've always been very intensely interested in these kind of intellectual exercises. How do you dissect these rules for the best optimal result? That's a way I think about the world now.
Okay.
I run a business now. I have a very kind of unconventional approach to the market that I'm in, and I would think that my ability to think like that, at least either I'm natively able to do that and that makes me good at gaming, or gaming pulled that out of me, and I think...
Okay. Yeah. In high school, well, you mentioned your parents kind of, they were kind of pressuring you to go to college.
Very much so, yeah.
So that means that they kind of had a sense that you were on your way to down a non-traditional path.
Oh, yeah.
Was that because of gaming, or was that because of your... Because I know, like,
all
me, like, I've always had... In high school, I was always more interested in comics and Magic than I was anything in school, for the most part.
Yeah.
Which, and it reflected in my grades. I don't know. Was that the case for you?
I was a C&D student most of the time, but I got a perfect SAT, so I was in a weird spot on the bell curve or whatever, where obviously very innately intelligent, but completely not engaged. So yeah, I was certainly a lackluster student, always have been. I mean, when I was in, I guess like, one of my stories my mom told me, I was in, I don't know, like first grade or kindergarten or something, and I would get in trouble because I would be ignoring the class. I'd just be sitting in the corner, literally reading the encyclopedia, just cover to cover, ignoring the teacher. And I would get in trouble for that.
For reading the encyclopedia.
And ignoring the spelling bee or whatever we were supposed to be doing.
Have you always been like that? Like, have you always, like, just kind of forged your own path?
I think so, yeah. That's definitely my MO.
Okay. Because, I mean, it sounds like you that's what you did in college. I just didn't know if you, like, if that had basically been a continuation of what you were doing, oh, yeah, like really early on.
Yeah, I mean, I'm almost surprised I got out of high school. If I had been a little bit gutsier back in the day, I could have seen myself maybe even dropping out of high school. School and I clashed badly.
And just the authority and or the structure,
yeah,
or
basically, I mean, I'm interested in what I'm interested in. I'm not interested in what you think I should be interested in. And maybe I'm not saying that that's a good way to behave or not. That's just the way that I was. And I got along okay in school. I would certainly rather be doing anything else than not enjoy school.
Mm-hmm.
And in an adult, I've not enjoyed. I did like the Science Center job because it was kind of it's a creative job I had, and I was in the creative department, whatever, and they kind of left us to our own devices. I think it's kind of rare the way they do that now, but Science Center was a great job doing CAD for them because we just get a project and there was no real oversight. We just deliver the end product.
Mm-hmm.
Other jobs I had where I've worked for other people have been much more frustrating. I worked in real estate for a while after Magic Business closed in like kind of like mainstream commercial real estate, and I don't know, like was not a good fit. As soon as I learned the business, as soon as I could start my own thing, I did. So like 2010,
okay,
I started Roman Industries, my business, which I buy and sell houses in the worst neighborhoods you can imagine in North St. Louis. I found this kind of strange niche where there was, you know, it's very bad. It earns its bad reputation. I would certainly advise no one should live there, but it's undervalued even for that. And
okay,
I was able to analyze that, and we could buy these houses for basically nothing. We could buy a house anywhere between like $500 to $3,000, and then we can get it on a payment plan for like double that with somebody, and enough of them actually pay that we make money. So that's
okay.
That's my income now.
Cool. And then I'm going to kind of pump the brakes on that one.
Okay.
As I have one last thing to go to ask about your parents.
Yeah.
Were they ever concerned about your interests? Like were they ever concerned about your performance in school? Like, were they ever, cause I know like my mom was always sort of like reticent about letting me do whatever I wanted because like, for example, I was always frustrated because I felt that I was a really good kid,
mm-hmm,
and that, yes, I would stay up till 3 a.m. on school nights, or I would stay up until 3 a.m.
Yeah.
I was playing Dungeons and Dragons.
Right.
Like, with my friends. I wasn't drinking, I wasn't smoking,
right,
or anything like that. Did you have a similar experience?
I also did not get into anything intoxicating until after high school. I was just a complete geek doing my geek thing. I didn't have my first drink until I was in college. But, yeah, I got a lot of lectures from my parents about studying more, etc. And I wasn't defiant, but I would just kind of, like, sit there and nod my head and, like, no, I'm not going to do anything differently. Like, I'm not going to lie to you.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I'm just not going to do it. So there was a lot of conflict like that. I would say my parents are great people, and I think they raised me extremely well. We have a difference of opinion on that topic, but I didn't feel like I was being oppressed, so I mean, I still get along great with my dad. My mom died recently, but my parents and I got along fine.
Okay, cool. And sorry to hear about your mom.
It's
always a terrible experience.
Mm-hmm.
I lost my dad, so anyway.
Yes.
So when you were, let's go to the kind of wild frontiers of owning a magic shop days. I've heard a lot of really cool stories.
Oh, really?
From your shop.
Well,
that it was kind of like a clubhouse.
Exactly.
I've heard of, like, since the building was not in the best condition, you guys would customize it.
So it was this medical building at like Chippewa and Hampton kind of area that was about 30% occupied, and so we kind of had the run of the place because the condition was that we could not be open during normal business hours. We kind of got the place as a favor, and the deal was, okay, you can have this place, you can do your crazy magic card firehouse thing, but don't mess with the real tenants. So we were there from like 5 p.m. until like 7 a.m. every night. and like, you know, shopping cart races up and down the hallways, and you know, this what was that Jack Nicholson movie with the hotel in the mountains?
Oh, The Shining.
Yes, very The Shining-esque kind of layout. This like early 70s, never updated, red carpeted medical building. It was a great experience for me because it was like the first time I was just completely in control of my world. That this is my place, these are my friends, everybody comes to hang out with me, I'm kind of like the host. It was suddenly, I just got promoted to be president of the frat. It was a lot of fun.
So yeah, it was, from what I understand, it was more like a fraternity than it was actually a, I mean, it was a functional business, it sounds like.
It was. We had these Bosnian kids would come in and buy sodas and play video games, and there were people I didn't know, obviously, walk-in business would occur. And then we would also host tournaments, and people from farther afield would come and play. But there was probably a core group of, like, 10 to 15 guys that were there, you know, at least a couple times a week. And we were, you know, it was basically us.
Okay. And how did you get that started? Like, how? What did you... Because people who listen to this are obviously very, like, a varied population. So some of them may be looking to approach... opening a DIY magic shop, like, well, how did you approach it?
I was pretty reckless. I'm not the most conscientious businessman. I just had some money saved up from, you know, like working for the Science Center and some of my family briefly. And I was friends with popular players. There was an opening in the market. I don't think at that time there was a single magic shop in the city of St. Louis. They were all out in the county or east side.
Okay.
So there was an opening. I kind of swung a sweet, sort of shady deal on some space. I don't know if we ever had an occupancy permit or anything like that. And I don't know. I don't have the best advice for doing a blackboard magic card shop. The books were, you know, spotty. I was 23 or 4, and basically I was there just to play magic all day, not to keep books and do that sort of stuff. So we made enough to survive, but it was pretty fast and loose.
Okay. And what is your favorite story from that era? I'm very curious.
That's a good question. Sometimes we'd have, like, airsoft gun battles in the middle of the shop. We'd watch movie marathons. And it was like a frat. We'd also just playing magic around the clock. There was a bunch of big tournaments there that were fun. There was a couple dramatic fights. I don't want to... bring up bad memories for the people involved, but it was a very happening social place for that circle of geeks.
Cool. And all the while, you were surrounded by people who, I imagine a lot of your friends were going to college.
Yeah.
Were you ever, like, comparing yourself to them and, like, feeling like you were different? Like, that maybe you were making a mistake by not going, or maybe because a lot of people... A lot of magic players, especially like Caleb, for example, he was a magic player through college, and that's what he was doing while going to college. Like,
well, I didn't know exactly. I knew the magic shop was not the life goal.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it was certainly not a cash cow. We were basically making ends meet. So I didn't really know exactly what I wanted to do with my life at that point. I knew I was miserable in college, so I assumed I would eventually stumble upon to another business opportunity at another level, which is exactly what happened.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think I was like filled with self-doubt or anything, the fact that I was running the shop instead of going to school. I mean, I didn't really have a plan, but I wasn't that worried.
Okay. And when you were kind of getting better, because all the time you were, you know, you opening the shop, you started playing magic, and then you open the shop, and then you start getting better at magic. What was kind of that path like?
When I first started playing, I was extremely obstinate in insisting on doing my own, you know, very amateur rogue deck ideas. That last, I'm sure many people went through that phase.
I had a Pestilence deck.
Okay.
That had Cemetery Gates in it.
Skull Clan. I played this terrible combo deck, Kobold Clan. That was my, I would live and die by that deck, mostly died, for probably 9 months when I first started playing Magic. This Skull Clan combo. And then I eventually, I don't know, people wanted to play. I was, you know, fairly good at playing this terrible deck. So people would like me to play test with them, and they would hand me, you know, here's an actual tier deck. And then I was like, you know, this is actually kind of fun. It's kind of fun to see a really efficient interactions, why this is a good deck. And then I said, okay, it's okay to play good decks. And then I actually started winning in, you know, at least the local tournaments. And then I did apply some ingenuity to what was the standard model of dice, and I found a real breakthrough winner in that format, which I then dominated at least the Midwestern vintage Magic scene for probably a solid 2 years.
And then, so were you at the time, were you just playing Magic, or were you playing, was the aspiration to go, get on the Pro Tour, or were you just trying to win enough money? Like, what was your end goal?
Well, I was making money running the shop mainly, and playing at first sometimes we just need another person for a tournament or something, and then I actually just genuinely enjoyed playing Vintage to the best of my ability. So I was mainly playing tournaments just for the glory. It's the joy of competition. Kind of got a big ego, and I liked hearing my name on the internet of, wow, this is a good win for Bronin. I'll completely admit it. That's what I wanted. So I was playing it for the notoriety.
Dare I say you were a glory seeker?
Yeah, absolutely. the money that came with it, which is certainly not lucrative, was, I don't know, a good bonus, nice kudos. I could, throw that one out there. I think my most notable achievement, this is probably summer of 2005, there was some weekend where there was a Black Lotus tournament in Chicago and in St. Louis, one on Saturday, one on Sunday, and I won them both back to back with 2 hours sleep.
Wow.
You know.
And not being Vintage World champs.
I came in third and ninth in two different Vintage World
champs. Oh, okay. Justin said you had won one.
I had never won the World Champs. I finished well twice. There was the Star City Power 9 tournaments they used to run, where they gave away a set of Power 9 to the top 8. I won two of those, and I top 8ed, I think, another two. So there was a lot of trips to Chicago
back then. Now, in Vintage, the Vintage World Champs, you didn't win that.
Mm-hmm.
That seems like the king of the hill. In terms of in the Vintage community.
The thing with single elimination, though, once you get it, I feel like anybody gets a top 8, it's kind of a crapshoot past then. Making top 8, anytime I make top 8 in a tournament, I feel like I've done my job for today. If I end up winning, that's obviously brilliant, but I don't feel that bad when you lose a best of 3 in single elimination.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that I never won Vintage Worlds, I still think I'm one of the best during that era.
Okay. Yeah, and you're traveling to go to places.
Yeah.
It seems like a traveling band with Robert Vroman would be just as wild and loose as a band with Vroman at home. Was that the case?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, we had good times driving. I mean, it was probably every other, one to three times a month we were going to Indianapolis or Louisville or Chicago. Yeah, lots of good road trips. That was a regular highlight of my existence back then. Nowadays, though, I can't imagine driving all the way to Chicago just to play Magic. That it boggled my mind that I used to do that. Not discounting that you shouldn't do that, but nowadays, I go to Jeff City pretty often for political stuff, and that's an hour and 45 minutes, and that feels like a real haul.
Is it just a trip, or just
the fact that I remember
the EV or
just the time, the 10 hours round trip of just physically moving myself to Chicago is not something I would really spend 10 hours on at this point in my life.
Okay. And do you have any cool travel stories? I mean, I know one time I'm going to kind of indulge here. So we came to St. Louis, actually. I believe it was St. Louis for a big tournament, probably a PTQ. But we had actually decided that we all got one hotel room, as you do.
Yeah.
And at the end of it, we decided we were going to turn the whole hotel room into a clubhouse.
Okay.
We flipped the mattresses. We stacked the chairs on top of the chest of drawers to make the tent pole. We used the sheets and everything. Everything that we could possibly include in this fort, we used. And then we put a sign on the door that said, "No girls allowed." And then we just left it there.
Okay. I will say nothing on the hotel end. We were serious minded guys. We go show up, maybe have a couple drinks, but basically go to bed and be ready to play. Oh my god, an entire solid day of mentally excruciating Magic Gathering. I mean, I had a lot of friends in the circle of the decent vintage players around the country that I would only see at these, you know, events around the Midwest. So it was cool, you know, being able to maintain a friendship with somebody that you will, there's really no reason I would ever run across this person except at these tournaments.
Uh-huh.
And we would have, you know, mutual respect and talk about whatever we're doing that day.
And then, so, like, all the while, you kind of are surrounding yourself with guys.
Yeah.
Where do girls and dating kind of fit into all this?
I highly recommend online dating. It's worked
okay.
very well for me. I don't know. So here's my philosophy on, like, OkCupid and those kind of things. This is perfect for geeky guys. And the reason why is, you know, it's kind of like Dungeons and Dragons or something. You are basically writing a character sheet of who you want to be, within reason.
Okay.
So, like, with a real amount of effort, how could you actually improve yourself realistically? Okay, well, then just say that's you, all right? And you say that, and then if some girl reads that and decides she's interested in that person, well, now you have incredible motivation to actually be that person. Because
okay.
you know now that it will get you laid. So I feel online dating, in addition to actually being useful in the goal of meeting and going out with women,
uh-huh.
is also, for me, I was kind of, I could see it as an engine up for self-improvement.
I've never heard it put that way, but that's very apt.
So, I don't know, think about it like that. Just try to be different.
And what was your profile like? What
I,
was your
well,
what
I have
was
pretty,
your character sheet like?
I have a pretty genuinely insane resume. Like, I mean, I've got, we could talk about North St. Louis for a long time. I have seen some many bizarre things.
No, I mean, like, when you were crafting your own
right. so
profile.
Just, so I basically just, here's the crazy stuff I do with my life, which is so far out of the ordinary. You know,
okay.
I lived in a dentist's office as a professional magic player for 2 or 3 years. And then, you know, I do all these political activist stuff, which has gotten me a little bit of notoriety in that circle. And then I go into the heart of the ghetto almost every day and see that, you know, basically third world environment. So I personally have a lot of interesting things in my life that I can advertise.
Okay.
That was my secret, I guess.
What is the craziest thing you've seen in North St. Louis? Crazy being a term you can define however you want.
Okay. I mean, it is, people don't understand how vastly different it is up there. So how I buy these houses, we get there. If you're 3 years or more behind in your property taxes in the city of St. Louis, the city will seize it and auction it. And as you might imagine, most of the houses they're seizing are in North St. Louis. So it's about 1,500 of these a year go for auction, and I go and look at every single one. And most of them, the reason no one's paid taxes is because somebody died 10 years ago and nobody's maintained it and it's boarded up and falling apart. So those
okay.
we skip. We still gotta go look at them. So I go into all these, you know, falling down slums, trying to find the ones that are, you know, maybe 10% of them are still worth buying, but I'm the only guy who's actually doing that research. So we go into a lot of basically unlivable buildings, and I've run into a number of squatters. One time, the front door was just open, walk in, and there's some woman with a needle in her arm just staring at me. And I'm like, oh, sorry to bother you, and just walk right out. And she probably thinks she's in some kind of dream. That a white guy in the middle of Fairground Park area just walking through her house while she was shooting up. One of the houses I bought, the guy who lived next door is an actual pimp. He has his women that he rents out or however he does his business. And, you know, I don't ask questions, but he introduced himself to me as that. So we kind of got to know him because we were doing work there for, like, weeks. And we were piling up these bricks in the backyard. We had to knock down a garage. We got these piles of bricks, which we can then sell for minuscule profit. But we're on a lunch break, and so these, like, 11-year-old kids come by and start smashing our bricks just for fun, okay? So my next-door neighbor hears these bricks smashing and then kind of an angry conversation. We're telling these kids to get lost, and he whips out his Glock and is, you know, waving it at these 11-year-olds. And he seemed, you know, if they were going to pick up a brick at him, he was going to lay him down. So, I mean, I've never once felt threatened myself. My theory is they all think I'm a cop. I've actually had that expressed at me many times. Because the way we enter these neighborhoods, you know, we don't always know exactly where we're going. We got this list of addresses. We're driving kind of slow, looking left and right, like two white guys. And then they hear the, you know, whoop, whoop, 5-0, and some guy with dreadlocks in the corner is, you know, flagging that, you know, the police have entered the block, everybody scatter. So that's happened probably 10 or 12 times.
Okay.
So nobody ever messes with me, and I just, you know, I mind my own business, and I'm doing my thing, and they're doing their thing. I've been solicited for drugs, I don't know, dozens of times.
Okay.
Sometimes they're very, very open and aggressive. I've had a guy jog alongside my driver's side window, flashing his bag of coke. You know, what do you want? What do you want? What do you want? And I'm literally here. I'm here by houses. Sorry.
And from what I've heard about the Roman owning the store era, and that from the people that have kind of come up out of that,
yeah,
is that it was also, in addition to kind of a magic fraternity, it was kind of a philosophy fraternity.
That's true.
Like, I've heard that there was a lot of like, anarchist thought to come from that. Can you want to talk about that a little bit?
So, I'm a hardcore libertarian. I'm not a fan of the government at all. I've put a tremendous amount of thought into that. I could go on that topic for hours. But, yeah, that's my ethos, for sure. And my best friend at the time, Josh Smith, we share the same philosophy. They helped us become friends, obviously. Well, he and the cash register most of the time. Then I was doing, you know, maybe other business tasks or just dicking around or whatever. But yeah, everybody that came through, whenever it came up, either one of us, that I guess the two, you know, the people that were behind the counter, were both very interested in talking about this, and we got a lot of smart kids here. And yeah, whenever it came up, and so I would say yes, there's probably a dozen people that have a significantly more libertarian outlook to their life, having interacted with ogres than otherwise they would have encountered.
And what was that like, kind of developing, in terms of developing your own philosophies? Like having that constant sounding board and...
Well,
and
at that point I was like 24, and I had been just on fire about this stuff all through like late high school and what should have been my normal college years. So I was quite well-versed in my topic at that point. I was pretty much a, you know, a well-read expert by then. So I was more just the lecturer than having a dialogue. But yeah, it was good to have eager listeners, intelligent people that would actually put some thought into it. And you know, I was never got hostile or anything.
Okay.
You happen to be a socialist, okay, we can still play magic. And,
Being the expert, was there ever a point that you were, that somebody said, like, changed your view significantly in, like, a surprising way?
Yes, I will say.
Okay.
Probably one of the most formative moments of my early life, I was in kindergarten. I was 6 years old or something. And my parents were fairly traditional Republican conservative Christians. And I wouldn't say they're overbearing about it, but that was just the worldview I was, you know, initially brought up in. And so one day in class, this little girl, the teacher is telling some Bible story or something. And this is just like a public school kindergarten. It wasn't a religious school, but she says something about the Bible, the teacher does. And this little girl raises her hand and says, "My mommy says that God's just a fairy tale." And at that moment, I look at her, and it had never occurred to me that anybody thought differently than my parents. I just thought my parents would tell me this is the way things are, and that it was unanimous agreement that this is the world. And it never occurred to me that it was even possible to think something differently. And that was just a shocking revelation at a very young age. I remember I went home and I told my mom, I was like, "I think there's a Philistine in my class," which was the closest word to atheist that I had from whatever Sunday school stuff they had taught us, that the Philistines are the ones that smashed the temple or something. And so she laughed, and then it really sank in, like, man, this is not guaranteed that what I'm being told is true. And I don't know, I feel like I kind of like became an adult at that moment, that I was just totally skeptical from then on out on everything. And my innocence ended at that moment.
And were your parents ever frustrated by that?
Shockingly not.
Okay.
I remember I was about 10 years old, and I told my mom, "Hey, you know what? It's Sunday morning. You're all going to church. I'm not interested." And I wasn't mad. I was like, "Hey, I just don't really want to do this anymore." And she let me do it. Looking back, considering my mom was pretty serious Christian, I feel quite lucky that she made no issue about it whatsoever. I mean, she asked me a couple more times, and then just was not a thing. So
wow, okay.
I feel lucky that I didn't was there's no long term guilt trip.
Okay, well that's good.
Yeah.
I was one of the. I guess my mom's more of a progressive Catholic, but she always wanted me to go to church and mm-hmm. felt like it was a. Now it's like a favor, kind of like to her. It's like kind of a present.
Sure.
Almost. And then when you, so the Roman owns the shop years kind of wind down and you kind of transition out of that.
Yeah.
What inspired that transition?
Well, the business kind of crashed and burned. We got letters from the city that, you know, the building was in sad shape.
Okay.
They shut down the building. An opportunity to maybe relocate nearby. There's going to be a lot of work. And also at the time, I had a girlfriend that was not going well at all. And that was kind of a soul-sucking period of my life. And so I just kind of, all right, we're just going to have to let this go and regroup and do something else. And then I got another, I dumped her eventually. But then I got a job doing real estate via my family. So about 2 years after that, I was a little bit kind of not doing what I wanted and was frustrated, but I rebounded relatively quickly.
Okay. And then you kind of, so you started your own real estate business. What inspired the transition from working for a traditional real estate mm-hmm. firm into working like for yourself in that capacity? And like, how did you come across the idea to buy these incredibly cheap properties in North St. Louis?
Well, I'm a bit of a gambler. I'm okay with high risk, high reward. I know I still don't have health insurance. I never have. I don't know. I'm okay with going to places that other people are just unwilling to. And so I'd saved up a fair amount of money doing this job. And certainly my goal was to go on my own as soon as possible. So I had some savings, and I also, you know, I don't get along with institutions. College did not go so well, so I don't really want to deal with banks. I have taken a lot of questionable choices in my past, and from the perspective of a bank, I am not a good risk. I think I'm extremely good risk, but not on paper. So my credit score was shit, and I couldn't deal with banks, so I had to spend my own money, you know, no mortgage, just cash. I'm like, okay, so what can I actually afford? And I kept going further and further down the tiers of quality real estate until I found, man, there are stuff that, you know, a fraction of them are still livable for sometimes under $1,000 in North St. Louis, which to me, like many people in the rest of, I guess, normal suburbia, North St. Louis is just a big question mark. I didn't know anything about it. Just, it's shocking. It's like Haiti. It's really bad. The buildings are crumbling. I mean, some of these areas, like 63107, I think, which is kind of like you take Grand all the way up to 70 and you stay on the west side of 70, that little pocket up there, it's like 102% of the people there are on welfare or some kind of government assistance.
Wow.
Because everybody who has a fixed address is either on disability or welfare or something like that. And many people who are just around receiving welfare without necessarily being a citizen of that area. And it's just completely crushed economically. The city government is largely to blame, and I have a whole diatribe about that. But North St. Louis is a different world.
And then you start your own business.
Yeah.
Like, what's your day like now? I mean, what's an average day in?
Well, it's been pretty darn hectic lately. This winter has been brutal. There's been constant problems. Basically, I do all the accounting myself, so there's a fair amount of office work. But you know, I drive around to these get on neighborhoods and we fix problems. I got my Jake Kerr, I'll give a shout out to him, a longtime employee, was one of my central employees back at the old magic shop and has been tagging along ever since. And so now he's sort of like my foreman. And we go, we deal with the endless maintenance problems. And I spend a lot of time on political stuff. I go to Jeff City pretty often to do lobbying. I've got a title with the Republican Party. I got elected to be the 5th Senate District Committee Man on the state party, which means technically I represent the east part of the city for the state level Republican Party in Missouri.
Okay.
Basically just because nobody else wanted the job because it's a downtown St. Louis, very few Republicans. But that gives me a title, which I've used to go advocate for my pet causes. And the state reps, they will actually give you, you know, a piece of their time if you have some back credential like that.
Okay.
So I get to talk to actual elected officials, and Show Me Cannabis is the organization I'm helping the most lately, with John Payne, who, I don't know if he ever played Magic, but he's certainly friends with a lot of Magic players.
Okay.
Is running that now.
What do they do?
We are trying to legalize marijuana in the state of Missouri.
Oh, okay.
They played a significant role in getting marijuana decriminalized in the city of St. Louis, which means it's still illegal, but if you're caught with less than an ounce, it's just a traffic ticket, sort of a fine instead of going to jail.
Okay.
And then also in, I think, Columbia and Springfield, Missouri, also has been, that level of reform has been done, and now we're trying to do it statewide. And it's moving along. It's probably not passing this year, but we're thinking 2016, it's looking like better than 50-50.
Okay. And where do you lean, sort of, politically? Like, you are a ranking member of...
I would say I'm a Ron Paul Republican. I'm from the Libertarian wing of the Republican Party. I've worked on the two Ron Paul campaigns in 08 and 2012. I was fairly instrumental in whatever progress was made in that. We got a bunch of delegates. This has all become quite technical, but we succeeded at the local level both times around. Obviously, the larger national forces at work were very much against this. But that's one of the sort of, like, you know, same thing where I've taken a novel approach to a number of problems I presented with either Type 1 Magic cards or this real estate market. In political organizing, I think there's really an opportunity in this kind of the inner city urban areas where the Republicans are so anemic to not necessarily elect Republicans, but just use the hierarchy of the party that's pretty vacant to become a platform for, you know, for in my case, for libertarian views, but I don't know, whatever you want. Like,
okay.
I assume in other Rust Belt cities, like Cleveland and Louisville, whatever, it's probably the same situation where the Democrats have a total stranglehold, and anybody can just show up and say, I'm a Republican, and I believe XYZ, and whatever your XYZ is, well, now you're the voice of the Republican Party in that city, and there's nobody to tell you you're wrong. The higher-ups can't say you've got to shut up because they got nobody to replace you with.
Yeah. And why political activism? Like, what kind of inspires you to do that?
I have very strong ideas of what should be done differently, and I don't pretend that I'm going to become president someday or that someone who thinks like me will, but I don't know. I'm a sucker for expressing my opinion. I really want people to know that they're wrong and I'm right, and this is, I have put immense amount on this. So, I want to advertise my views, which I feel are inescapably logical, and yet in the political environment, like in business, if you've got a really logical idea, you mm-hmm. make a lot of money, and you've proven it, and you win. In the political world, though, you can have the best ideas, and that has no bearing on what actually comes out of the system. The system is just who gets the most drones, making the most phone calls, gets their guy elected, and it matters zero what that guy actually thinks. It's just who has the better network of marketing. So I'm trying to do my bit to combat that marketing.
So do you think it's a genuine interest in people or in,
I'm interested in the ideas.
Like improving people's lives?
Yes.
Or,
okay. I think if we got rid of a lot of government intervention, all our lives would be much better. I think the state is pretty much everything they do is bad. We think the wars is literally killing people and all the wasteful taxing spending is impoverishing people. I think it is the government is uniformly awful.
Now, one question I like to
yeah.
pose to my friends who, like, in St. Louis, yeah. having moved here, I have garnered a lot more, I've gained a lot more anarchist friends.
Okay.
Or anarcho-capitalist friends.
Yeah.
Like, why not fix it? And not why throw the baby out with the bathwater?
All right. Well, I don't think it can be fixed. I think the way the system is designed is specifically to do what is going on right now.
Okay.
It's designed to enrich the cronies. There's just too much money in the central pool. The federal government of the United States is so large. They're taking in, what is it, like $2 or $3 trillion a year now. is just so unimaginably large sums of money that you can support this entire industry of lobbyists whose whole job it is to get a piece of that money for whoever's backing them. And while you're at it, getting more money for us, why don't you just put more money into the pool and as a whole? And so you just get this cycle of they always want more money into the central pool, and there's always more people who can make a living just negotiating for a piece of that without actually producing anything. So you've got this whole class of lawyers and lobbyists that pretty much control the country, and their only goal is to get more money in the pot and get more of the money out of the pot to their little interest. And these people produce nothing. They're only just shuffling the stolen money from the taxpayers. That's their existence. If you got rid of that you can't just spend money on anything in government, then those people would have to go, you know, do something useful. And they would actually be contributing to the economy and not only being parasites, but being part of a system that encourages more of them. It's a bad feedback loop. And that's why... So now the tax income, the federal government is like $2.5 trillion or something like now, and they're spending double, $4 to $5 trillion.
Mm-hmm.
And the mainstream view is that this is just completely sustainable and acceptable, that we are always just going to be adding, we're spending literally double our income year after year after year. That's madness. But they do it, they have all their spin doctors saying, oh, this is great, you got Paul Krugman, that we can operate on this debt economy. Because it's in their best interest to spend this money, and they don't want to stop spending the money, and they don't care if it's going to cause terrible problems down the line. And that's basically the way that every nation state has been constructed in the first world since World War II, is that system just only larger and larger.
Okay, so you're for, like, how would you change it? Like, well, would you get rid of the whole thing, or would you replace it with, like, so smaller local governments? I mean, are you...
I would say decentralization is always better. I think, the federal government is just too big. You've got countries like Iceland, for example, which is, maybe like a 30th the size of the United States economy. It's tiny.
Uh-huh.
But it's pretty much the exact same structure. It's the exact same organs of government, same kind of corporations, same kind of relationships. But it's really not that bad. There's not that much corruption in favor trading, because there's just so much less money in the pool that you can't support that many people whose job it is to put more money in the pool. Whereas America, we just got this runaway feedback loop. So if each state government was responsible for their own finances completely, there was no central pool, yes, then we'd kind of be resetting back to like Iceland level corruption. It would not go away, but the larger the concentration, just the worse it gets, and it just continuously spirals out of control. So greatly reducing the power of the federal government to spend money, perhaps at all, would be a good way to reset the corruption level.
Okay. Now, I'm going to kind of take us one way and then back to the other.
Sure.
Going back to magic.
Yes.
When you developed the decks that you developed, like the Uvas decks, and how did you kind of approach those decks specifically? For people who want to know kind of the history of those decks that may not know about them.
So the inspiration for Uvastats, I was playing, at the time, I was playing a whatever the mainstream winning workshop deck was, because I don't know, it just seemed so powerful, the 3 mana for nothing. So I was playing a workshop deck, and then I read this article, I don't remember who wrote it, where this was kind of like it was one of the very first like magic theory articles I'd ever read. And he broke down the Vantage metagame at a time that there was 5 unrestricted cards that were kind of like the the archstone or whatever of different archetypes, which in his estimation were, I believe it was Mana Drain, Mishra's Workshop, Bazaar of Baghdad, Dark Ritual, and Null Rod. Those were the 5 cards that were unrestricted that fueled decks.
Okay.
And at that point, they were basically isolated. Any deck that played one of those did not play any other 4. So I had a workshop deck, and this card, Umamask, got printed, which is a very strange interaction with the draw step, but it has this kind of broken exception with Bazaar of Baghdad, where it's this credible... It becomes... Bazaar of Baghdad just becomes tap draw 2 if you got Umamask in play.
Okay.
And then there's this other trick with Goblin Welder where you can swap out Umamask and you get to lock. You prevent them from ever drawing a card. And just Bazaar Baghdad and Welder is a good combination because you discard artifacts and weld them back in for Moxes, and suddenly you can turn 1 Mountain Welder, turn 2 Mox Bazaar, and you can have, Triskelion or something in play.
Okay.
Turn 2. are transferred. So the Sunday Workshop, bizarre bad dad connection. And then at the time, Fish decks were playing Nolrod to combat Workshop decks. That Nolrod was considered an anti-artifact card, Workshop was considered a pro-artifact card, considered bad synergy. I saw the exception to that is that Workshop makes so much mana, and it's not shut up by Nolrod, that you can afford to lose your artifact mana, and that's what keeps... That's how the Fish decks are beating the Control decks, is shutting off the artifact mana. So that's why they're playing that. So I just put all that together in one deck, the Workshop, Bizarre, Nolrod, and it was just a powerhouse.
Okay.
So that's where that deck came from. And it took, I don't know, 6 months of fine-tuning, and I played pretty much the same list for over a year.
What, were you ever considering adding Dark Ritual?
Well, no. I know. The colored mana sources were hard because red was the only color played.
Yeah,
yeah.
There were not
Dark Ritual, but there were five color stacks decks with City of Brass, stuff like that. I was never impressed with those. I think it was too dilute of a strategy trying to run the broken color restricted cards with Workshop. You know, you'd have too many times where your opening hand is like Workshop, Mox Sapphire, and you got like balance and time walk in your hand and you can't do anything. Where if those had been more artifacts or more mana that I don't know. The mana was shit. That was bad.
Okay.
But I mean one tournament, but I was not a fan.
And I've heard stories from like Justin was telling me stories where you would play Uba Mask and people would read it and then they would say okay. And then they would say, are you done? And then you would say yes. And then they would brainstorm.
Yes. That happened. There's two different pros did that against me. I don't want to say names because I don't 100% remember them, but it was a Gen Con in two different years where pretty much that exact scenario played out against alleged pros who were slumming it in the Vintage tournament.
And what was your favorite story? What's been your favorite story about that? Is that it? Or
those are good. Also, the look on their face the first time you explained the Welder Lock with you will never draw another card. That it was fairly gratifying, and they would of course never believe me, and there would be a judge lecture involved. So I got some troll points for that.
And the Welder Lock, that is, Uba Mask is in play. They draw their card during their draw step.
Yeah.
You weld out an artifact.
Yes.
You
ideally one Uba Mask for another, because the new Uba Mask does not remember the card that was removed.
Okay.
So you can just perpetually one for one Uba Mask every time their draw step comes around.
Wow! Unless they have an instant.
Correct. That's true. They play an instant, but what instant do they have? A counter spell. I'm not casting any spells.
Yeah, and I guess Lightning Bolt isn't a huge card in that format.
Certainly wasn't at that time.
Okay. And how did that feel to develop and be successful with your own deck? After years of building really bad like Kobold Skullclamp decks, you finally landed on something that was actually good.
I was immensely gratifying, I'll be honest. I would get emails from people in like Japan and the Netherlands on a weekly basis asking my advice about stuff. Yeah, I felt like a celebrity. It was really cool.
Sweet. And then you also developed an Oath of Druids?
Yeah. So I guess it was right after Zendikar got printed. There was that big angel that shuts off a color.
Iona.
Yeah, that one. Okay. So that card is obviously a really good Oath target. And I built a deck around that that turned Oath into a combo deck where you would mill your library under the protection of Iona that could frequently win on turn two or three with a lot of protection. And I won in like 2010, 2011. Not as much as Uba Stacks, but I did win a bunch of tournaments in the Midwest with that deck. Yeah, that was pretty fun. Cause it was, I don't know, it was another, I feel, pretty elegant way to take a conventional archetype. And so Oath was sort of a combo deck, but played normally more as like a control deck. And I pushed it way more into the combo direction. And it was powerful enough that sometimes I would just turn two wins, like match after
match. And how did it win, exactly?
There's some card, man, it's been years. It's a blue instant. It's kind of a niche. Blue instant, it flashes back for a green that shuffles back three cards into your library from your graveyard.
Memory's Journey?
Yes.
Okay.
So you oath up, Iona is the only creature in the deck. You oath up Iona. Like, ideally, you go turn one, Orchard, Forbidden Orchard, Mox, play Oath. They've got a 1-1 spirit. Next turn, you've got Iona. And then the next turn, you mill your entire library. And you Memory's Lab back, Black Lotus, and Yawgmoth's Will. You draw one of those per turn. And then there's another card, I think from like Judgment or something, where you can flashback for free and exile a blue card, and you get to draw, or you get to look at that many cards and draw one of them. It's like blue one, X to cast, and then the flashback is just...
Oh, exile. Yes. Okay.
So you can draw a card.
I can't remember the name of the card.
Right. So you just exile that and like one blue card, and then you get to look at top X and draw one of them. Well, the X is just one, and it's definitely Black Lotus of Yawgmoth's Will. So that way, you draw two cards for a green and free off an empty library, which you know are Black Lotus and Yawgmoth's Will. Under the protection of Iona, they can't counter as Yawgmoth's Will. Replay all your artifact mana, Flare Academy, Tendrils.
All right.
Yeah.
That sounds fun.
Yeah. And if you're really ballsy and you happen to draw Iona and you know there's no creatures in your library and you think you can resolve Yawgmoth's Will, you can go for it, just immediately oath into an empty library and try to win without the Iona protection. I've done that a number of times.
And were you as proud of that deck as you were the Ubistax deck?
I'd say Ubistax is definitely my claim to fame, but I guess at that, when I was playing the Oath deck, Workshop decks for some reason were on the decline. I don't remember the exact history of the metagame, but I had been losing with Ubistax for a number of months, and so I finally switched to playing blue cards, which I was kind of a big adjustment, a very different style than I've been playing my entire Magic history. So Workshop is entirely sorcery speed deck.
Yeah.
Well, other than Goblin Welder. But the cards on your hand, so there's a lot less, I don't know, eyeball-to-eyeball interaction the way there is when you're bluffing counter spells, and it's particularly in Type 1, where you are trying to resolve Ancestral Recall or something, there's a lot more in the line. So, yeah, I got pretty good at that.
Okay. Ultimately, what is it about Vintage that's always caught your attention as opposed to every other format?
It just feels more creative and open-ended, and even though like you get, you know, you just get embarrassed. I'm playing Workshop and I'm on the draw, and the guy turn one ritual combos me, and like, okay, But even allowing for that, I guess I like Gim. I like the high stakes. I like high risk, high reward, where you can do really cool, devastating things. And if you just hope that that happens more often for you than them by being really good, I don't know, that's what I like. I like.
But you weren't gambling, like you weren't playing those. Like that's you were playing a really really fair deck.
I mean, no,
relatively.
If,
like,
if you go turn one Workshop Trinisphere, that's the same as going turn one Ritual off into a combo. If you go turn one Trinisphere on the play, you just won with a two card combo. You won the game.
Okay.
I can see
really that. Okay.
Unfair, in fact. Stacks going first is maybe the most unfair thing in the format.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, it just seems like, I guess, Stacks being... I guess it's not an overly, like... Since it's not a, like, super combo deck,
yeah.
It seems like the fun police deck in the format.
Well, you probably played... If you played Legacy Stacks...
Uh-huh.
Okay, so Legacy Stacks is much more like that, because without the huge mana advantage, you do feel like you're barely trying to contain the very relevant things that they're trying to do all the time. Whereas in Vintage Stacks, I'd say, you know, 25-30% of the time, they're basically doing nothing the entire game. You are just shutting them down from the very first instant, and they have to bend over backwards, and maybe every once in a while they get out of it. But most of the time, you know, once you gain control of the game, it's just device and it never lets go.
Okay.
So that's what I liked. I don't know. I like... Stacks is just all-encompassing control. It doesn't matter what they're doing, because they can't do any spells at all, is the goal. Whereas control decks are either geared to more, like, either anti-creature or anti-other control. This is just more universal.
Okay, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And then taking the car back to, like, going another left turn.
Sure.
To kind of come back to the present.
Yeah.
You've been politically active, and recently you had... an insane experience that you wrote a long piece about on Facebook. In a nutshell, can you tell us about that experience?
Yeah,
how it inspired you to actually throw your hat in the ring?
Well, I was playing around before this, but this just gave me a pretty juicy thing to talk about. So I went to jail for 53 hours in the St. Louis City Justice Center, which is a shockingly poor-run place. And I had been briefly arrested before, like, on the county, which is, you know, it's boring and inconvenient, but it's kind of just the place you have to be for an arbitrary amount of time. This was hell. It's 29 people in a, like, size, room size of your kitchen, just laying on concrete, shoulder to shoulder, 60 degrees, reeks of urine, whatever you happen to be wearing when you come in there is what you're stuck with. Just constant noise and distractions, and you never really know what's going on. It was a Kafka hell. It was really bad. And I, no violence, I'm never afraid of my fellow prisoners, but just extremely cramped and unending conditions were awful. And this is routine. I was there on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. It's nothing special. This is just every day in this place. So I was already, you know, a big critic of the St. Louis City Police Department, criminal justice system in general. This blew my mind that this is normal. It's that bad. So I wrote a fairly fiery description of how unhappy I was about this, got some attention. I was interviewed with the RFT, and I was on some...
The RFT? What is that?
The Riverfront Times.
Oh, okay.
And then some conservative talk show guy at local radio had me on last week. So I am now, I guess, glad that it happened. It's given me some major insight and also a platform to... Now that I know that this is happening, I would like to change that.
While you were in jail,
yeah,
was there anything that changed or any thoughts that you had that weren't in the note?
Well, I didn't talk about the many fascinating people that I met in there. I just had traffic warrants. That's why I was locked up. I apparently missed the opportunity of when you get to call and pay money and get out of there. They just stuck me in there and ignored me for 2 days. And I guess that same bullet for everybody else. I mean, there was maybe 10-20% of these people were there for something serious, like assault or stealing a car. More than half were just there for traffic warrants or child support or some stupid municipal fine that had gone on too long, and then they get a warrant eventually, and now they're spending X days locked up in this hellhole.
Wow.
I talked, got nothing to do except the people that you're basically nose to nose with for days. So I learned all of their, depressing stories. And some of them are very cool people. And I actually Facebook friends with two of them now just from
being
locked up in city jail for 3 days.
And dealing with, like, the North City,
mm-hmm.
did you ever find yourself feeling a little bit of elitism that you weren't part of that?
Oh, well, I mean, I obviously not, and they know it. White privilege is a very real thing. I am treated by the police, even though I had this bad experience with jail. Prior to that, I've been pulled over many times in North St. Louis because they see a white guy, and I don't have the nicest car, a random car with a couple dents in it, whatever. They assume I'm, especially the way I drive in North St. Louis, I'm usually going kind of slow, trying to figure out exactly where I'm going. It looks like I'm shopping for drugs. I can see from the police perspective, that's what I look like I'm doing. So I get pulled over fairly often. But, as soon as I explain what's going on, like, I'm a businessman, here's my map of all the addresses I'm clicking around from, or whatever it is I'm doing, they immediately let me go. And often, I got pulled over a couple times when I had the warrants, and they still just let me go, just because I'm not a black drug dealer, and that's who they want to hammer on. So I've a good rapport with my tenants and the people I do business with in North St. Louis. And I'm a white guy that's coming into a neighborhood where basically it's the cops. It's the only white people they see.
Uh-huh.
So I think I do get some respect from the fact that I'm coming here. And the buildings I buy, if I had not bought them at these auctions, they go to the city as forfeited, and they just board them up and forget about them. So the fact that I bought this thing at the last minute and then did at least something to kind of keep it in circulation is strictly better than the alternative, which is just, you might as well just tear it down.
Uh-huh.
So I've had a couple instances where I knock on some middle-aged lady's door and say, hey, my name's Robert Roman, I just bought your house yesterday. And they hug me, and they, oh, you're my savior, and they're practically in tears that the house didn't go to the city, because they know they'd get kicked out.
Uh-huh.
Live with me, they've got an opportunity to maybe pay something and get it back, or we'll work out some kind of deal. So, I don't know. I feel like I'm doing good work.
Cool. And I guess what I was getting at was there was a sense of elitism.
Yeah.
when you were in jail, like, you're one of them now. Like, you're kind of in the shit. Like, I mean, I had an experience with Greyhound. And that is definitely not filled with the most affluent people. Did you kind of gain a sense of, like, a deeper sense of empathy with?
Oh, yeah.
This
is something that, you know, many of these people, this is their life. That even if they're not doing anything, you know, particularly felonious, just the traffic warrant cycle where you got to get a car to get to work, and then eventually you're going to get a ticket, and then your job may be pretty sporadic, and you just don't have enough cash in hand, well, you can't go to court, you can't pay it, so then you get a warrant, and eventually get arrested, and then you lose your job, and then you're back over at square one, and just over and over and over again. And, I mean, I heard this same refrain from a dozen people. So this is a very real phenomenon, and, I mean, I was kind of aware of that, but, yeah, hearing it in person from a face-to-face with somebody, that their life is basically being destroyed by just this petty desire for the city to extract a couple hundred bucks from people here and there, is just the spillover effects are just completely not considered, and it's really unacceptable. I will say, though, that, you know, from their perspective, I probably look like a well-to-do white guy. They were quite surprised to find that, in several cases, I met two different people that lived on the same block and were specifically aware of some of my tenants, and were pretty shocked to hear that, yeah, I own houses in Walnut Park and Bayes and Fairground. So that was cool that I guess some street cred. The Justice Center crowd.
Was there a story that particularly struck you while you were in jail?
So this guy, Lavelle Robinson, who I probably spent the most continuous time with, what I just said, he's lost his job 6 times from being arrested and missing work, every single time due to having failed to pay some fine of some kind or another. And that's it. And he is, you know, one of thousands of African-American males in American inner cities that have this same experience. There's one white guy. The white guys tend to be a little bit more train wrecks on average than the black guys. This one kid, he was like 28. He's dying of leukemia. And he has just adopted this complete, I have nothing to lose attitude. And he's completely addicted to painkillers. I just openly doesn't care. Like, yeah, I stole a car to feed my pill habit, and I got caught. And so here I am for the next 6 months, and now the state's going to pay for my pills for a while, and then maybe I'll get out, and I'm just going to do it again, and then I'll die. And it's like, wow, that's...
Wow. Heartwarming.
He was... I mean, except most people are just kind of like, you know, this just sucks, and hopefully this madness will end in the next 12 hours.
Yeah. Wow. Like, that's just crazy, the crazy experience.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Roman, what is in the future for you?
Well, I'm running for state rep right now in the 79th district, which is kind of like midtown in the city of St. Louis, from like Gravois and Jefferson all the way up to 70.
Do you own property in that district?
I do. Okay. I own a couple of houses in Northside around there.
Because I didn't know if that was like your district where you.
This is where I happen to live. I live at like Jefferson and Delmar right now. Downtown,
okay.
West. So I'm running a Republican in the city of St. Louis, so it's mainly, I'm just want a platform for my views. When you're on the ballot, they kind of have to pay a little attention to you. So that's the goal, is, you know, go to a bunch of neighborhood association meetings, try to get interviewed, stuff like that, and expound upon my many key issues of how the city government is doing a bad job. That's what I want to do. In the meantime, this summer is the tax auctions that I get all my inventory from for the business are during the summer. So I'm going to be very busy during that period, doing a lot of research and getting investment money together and stuff like that.
And do you ever wish it was a simpler time where you were just running a magic shop?
No, I'm
just
way more
play
fun
magic.
Now. This is way more fun. This is, I mean, it's sort of like a game. It's a big game. It's trying to take over a Rust Belt American city. And here's your, you can go political, you can go business. I mean, you can think about it.
You're doing both.
Yeah. So hopefully succeeding at least one of them.
Yeah. All right. Well, Robert, thank you very much.
Thanks, man. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, thanks.
Cool.
Turn down for what?
welcome back. Thank you for listening. Once again, this has been Across the Table 36 and my interview with Robert Vroman. As always, you can contact me with feedback on Twitter at Matt Mendoza or on Facebook at Across the Table Podcast. You can always hit me up via email at acrossthetablepod@gmail.com. And you can find the podcast on iTunes and menadeprived.com. Please leave me comments, reviews, positive feedback. Would love to hear from you. And I'd like to leave you with a small something that I'm doing. The video will be up as well. This weekend, as many of you know, was a very, very large Grand Prix. There was, I found out over Twitter, a 15-year-old kid from Brooklyn, New York, whose deck was stolen really early on in day one. And I don't know if you guys have ever had something stolen at an event. It's a pretty terrible experience. It pretty much ruins any sort of happiness you could possibly get from that event. As well, my trip to Grand Prix Las Vegas was a pretty life-changing trip, and I can't imagine what something like a theft would have done to that experience, to ruining that for me. So I found out about the deck from Twitter. I contacted my contact, and he sent me a deck list. So what I'm doing is, you'll be able to find the video on 5colormedia.com. I'm trying to replace it for him. It's blue-white-red control. It's a modern deck. It's not cheap, but I believe that with the donations and with the power of the Magic community, with as many good people as there are out there, I believe that we can do this for this kid and add a little bit of sunshine. Sounds kind of cheesy. And to let you guys know, I am going to be donating one of my Scalding Tarns as well as the sleeves for the deck and the deck box and as well as some of the other random commons. And I've already had a couple people donate some things, but I can't do this by myself. And I believe in you guys. So if you could, I will post the deck list in the show notes along with a list of what has already been donated. As well, I will be publishing an updated document on my site that basically will give you an opportunity to kind of promote the fact that you're donating to this cause if you would like. So any companies out there, you know, that you'd like to get your name out there, I'd love to have you, you know, it's a bit of not free advertising, but it's a bit of an advertising opportunity to both help you and help somebody else. So thank you very much for your time, and I hope you have a great week. Take care of yourselves. This podcast is a product of 5 Color Media, and I invite you to check us out at 5colormedia.com or on Twitter at 5 Color Media.